Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines. It's time to get revved up for sports, sports, and guess what? More sports on the RPM Roundtable Podcast with Robin Clark, Paul McGaughey, and Mike Sesney.
This is the RPM Roundtable Podcast on Thursday, June 6th. I'm the host, Paul. I'm here with Robin. Mike is running a little bit late. He's in a meeting right now. But we have special guest Ricky Bader. He's one of our classmates.
Thanks.
That's okay. We're going to start today's episode by talking about the NBA Finals, which get underway tonight with Game 1 in Miami with the Heat taking on the Spurs. And Ricky, what are your initial thoughts on this series?
Well, first, thanks for having me. My initial thoughts are that this is the series that, you know, if you're a true basketball fan, you were waiting for this year. I think last year I wanted to see this series happen, but obviously OKC put a damper in that when they defeated the Spurs. But I can't really even make a prediction of what's going to happen. There's so many factors, but I'm really excited for Game 1.
Now, there's a lot of storylines in this series. What would be, I guess, your favorite storyline?
Well, of course, you know, the rematch, LeBron versus Duncan, the whole revenge factor, the fact that Duncan swept him in 07, and now LeBron, completely different player, he's looking for revenge. That's the intriguing one. But also, you know, the Spurs back in the finals for the first time in, I think, 5 or 6 years, and do they still have what it takes to get it done?
Now, obviously, both of these teams are approaching dynasty status if they're not already there. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. The Spurs, Spurs are a dynasty. They won 4 championships in 9 years, and to me, you know, it's not a Bulls dynasty type thing, but it's very close.
It's okay. Now, Robin, I'll ask you this question. Obviously, the Heat assembled the Big Three in 2010 with LeBron, Wade, and Chris Bosh. Now, I certainly think that LeBron has separated himself from that group a little bit. Would you agree with that?
I definitely agree with that. I wouldn't even ever have called them the Big Three. I thought the Big Two and a Half was a better term, and now it's probably just the Big One. But obviously, Bosh and Wade, it was pretty well documented that they were horrible in the last series, and people are saying that Wade this season lost a step, although I still think he put up close to 20 points, and Bosh had a decent season too. So I don't think there's any chance that these guys can play worse than they did. So I'd expect them to pick it up a little bit. And Ricky, I was actually wondering for you, you've got LeBron with Wade and Bosh this year meeting San Antonio, and he met the Spurs with his Cleveland teammates back in, I think, 07.
Yeah, 07.
How much better is this Miami team than that Cleveland team was?
Well, there's so many factors because, you know, people in the last series were calling them the Miami Cavaliers because LeBron was carrying them on his own. So it really depends on how Wade shows up, and Bosh too. I mean, Bosh was, look, Wade has the injury excuse. I don't know what was up with Chris Bosh. It was kind of pathetic to watch, and it was really painful. I mean, he was grabbing like 3 or 4 rebounds a game. He wasn't hitting his shots. He wasn't aggressive. He was just shooting threes. Like, he needs to step his game up a lot.
And what about the difference between the San Antonio teams from now and then?
Well, that's a good question, and there actually is a big difference. See, back then, they were a defensive-oriented team. They were kind of like a grinded-out team. They really specialized on defense. Their offense was kind of slow-paced. And when they were losing those years in the playoffs, Greg Popovich decided, I'm going to make an adjustment. I'm going to make my team into a fast-paced, up-tempo team. Okay, we'll sacrifice a bit of defense, but we're going to change our identity. And it's really worked. I mean, last year they were so close to the finals. This year they kind of steamrolled their way there. So there is a big difference. So it's not like you can just take that team back then and compare it to now.
Now, with the Spurs roster, Tony Parker, a point guard, finished 6th in MVP voting this season. How important is he to the Spurs in this series?
Tony Parker, I have to say, I've been a Chris Paul guy. I've been saying that he's the best point guard in the league. I think Tony Parker overtook him this year. Absolutely unbelievable play. And in the playoffs, I mean, I don't know. Like, he really is the best point guard in the league right now. He is extremely important. Obviously, with the resurgence of Tim Duncan, that's been a huge factor in the Spurs' success. But look, they're going to live and die by how well Tony Parker plays. And I think he's going to abuse Mario Chalmers.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Now, let's just close off this segment by doing some predictions for the series.
Okay, I'm going to say Spurs in 6. As much as I do want to see LeBron hoist another trophy, I'm going to say Spurs in six because I just don't know which Dwayne Wade is going to show up. And it's so pivotal that he does play to the point where he's, you know, putting up at least 18 to 21 a game. And he just hasn't done that. I don't think he's going to be close to his best. So I just see the Spurs taking it with all their depth.
Finish this sentence for me, Ricky. The Heat will win if
Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh play like Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh. That simple.
Yeah, that's perfect. I totally agree with that. I don't think LeBron James can necessarily win this series by himself. When we come back, we're going to do one more basketball segment and talk about the Toronto Raptors. We're back on RPM, and before I forget, I just want to mention that this is coming to you courtesy of Centennial Internet Radio. As I mentioned, we're going to talk about the Raptors. This morning, guys, when I opened up the Toronto Star Sports section, I saw this full-page advertisement that I'll show you in a second. It's a picture of Masai Ujiri, the new general manager, holding the NBA Executive of the Year Award with the caption above it saying, "The ultimate goal is a championship." So, guys, just take a look at that.
This championship, yeah.
And I'd just like to get your reaction to that, because I thought it was, I don't know if funny is the word, but it definitely struck me.
Yeah, I've kind of been joking that Masai is the Raptors' new messiah, but he has a lot of work to do. But, it was a great signing. I mean, they put up the money to get him. They knew that he was their man, and I really think he's going to deliver, and I hope he will.
Now, news today that George Karl was fired by the Denver Nuggets with 1 year remaining on his contract. Mm-hmm. Won 57 games, obviously, with Masai Ujiri as the general manager there. And so now, do you see him being the next coach of the Raptors?
Man, and that's the first conclusion that people have jumped to.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, did Denver just want a clean house for whatever reason, for whatever stupid reason, or did George Karl go to them and say, you know what, I don't like the direction we're heading in. You fired our guy that compiled this amazing team, and I want out. So I think it's a definite possibility that he could come and coach the Raptors. Obviously, Masai Ujiri just recently said, I see no reason that Dwayne Casey won't be the coach. But, let's be real. If George Karl is available, you go after him very, very hard.
Absolutely. Robin, I wanted to ask you because when – well, actually, just let's hear your thoughts on what you think of that slogan, the ultimate goal is a championship.
Oh, I think the ultimate goal is to become relevant again before you win a championship. You got to walk before you run, right? And just I'd like to jump in just about the George Karl potential of going to the Raptors. I think that at this point, with the Raptors playing pretty bad basketball, and I don't think much is expected of them in the next year or two, why not bring in Karl, if for no other reason than to make the Raptors entertaining to watch? Because if the Raptors are going to consistently lose playing with Casey in these 82-79 games, mm-hmm. If you're going to lose 113 to 102 or whatever, I'll watch that. But I'm not going to watch losing when you're not scoring. Just touching on the headline, I think that it's sort of similar to what we saw with the Jays earlier this season. Mike and I were heading down to opening day, and the headline on the Toronto Sun said World Series or bust, which is completely ridiculous. People thought the Jays were going to be really good, and that hasn't worked out, at least so far. But I'm not convinced that is so different. Like I said, I just think the Raptors, the first step is to get back to relevancy.
Now, the old slogan is you're either selling wins or you're selling hope. And it's pretty clear that the Raptors are selling hope at this point. Would you agree with that, Ricky?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the difference between the Blue Jays is that, the championship was kind of expected this year. With the Raptors, it's obviously a long-term plan. He signed a 5-year contract. You can't expect him to come in right away, especially with no draft pick, and just turn the team around immediately. But what he can do is make an imprint. He's already fired Ed Stefanski, some scouts. First order of business in terms of player personnel is getting rid of Bargnani. So I think he can make moves that, make the team more relevant and progress toward being a lot better. Using the amnesty clause as well, I think Landry Fields is a perfect target for that, in my opinion. He just kind of has to undo some of these moves that Colangelo put in effect.
I would agree with that. I've heard Klaza's name tossed around as an amnesty possibility, too.
That's true.
I definitely think moving Bargnani out, that's a pretty obvious one, and may have even cost Colangelo his job ultimately, that he hasn't been able to move him before now.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how Ujiri shapes the roster heading into the 2013-14 season. When we come back on the RPM Roundtable podcast, we're going to talk some NHL playoffs, and Mike is back from his meeting, so he's going to join us.
Thanks for joining us, Ricky.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're back on RPM, and as promised, Mike has returned from his meeting, so yep. he's joining us for this segment.
I'm here. I'm back from the Soccer Canada meeting, I think I was at there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was the Soccer Fan Convention meeting.
How was the TFC game that you watched on Sunday?
Actually, I watched the Canada and U.S. women's whatever.
Did you really?
Game. No, not really.
I believed you. That was convincing.
Yeah?
Yeah,
should have rolled with that. But
I should have asked you what you thought of the celebration on the final goal to prove that you didn't watch it. But
it was pretty good. What was that?
Sydney?
Oh, yes. Sydney. So she, what'd she do? Because I didn't see that.
Basically, she... Do you know the story behind her? I guess we should tell all our
All I know is she was Brett Laurie's ex-girlfriend and... Anybody
okay.
who dates Brett Laurie can't be very smart.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much not the story. So basically, she was born to a Canadian mother, American father.
Oh, I did actually hear this, yeah.
She played on the youth team in Canada, thought that the U.S. was better and she would have a better opportunity. So then when she played international soccer, which is when you're over 18, she went to the U.S. and basically she scored the third goal after coming on as a substitute and then ran to the crowd and, like, you know, grabbed the crest and kissed it. And anyway, she's been taking a lot of abuse and people didn't like that too much. And she also tweeted after the game that, you know, that's what you get for racially abusing me or something like that, which she later clarified wasn't at the game.
So she pretty much is Brett Laurie.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
I see why they'd be a good match.
So let's transition to the NHL playoffs. In the East final, Boston won in double overtime yesterday. They have a 3-0 lead in the series. I want to look at the goal differential, which is 11-2 in favor of the Bruins so far. Now, overall, Pittsburgh and Boston are tied for the most goals in the playoffs with 49, but it would appear that the Penguins have gone a little bit cold in this series. Robin, what are your thoughts on that?
A little bit cold, yeah. You went easy on them. The Penguins have been pretty brutal. I didn't actually catch the game last night, but I did see the highlights of it. And the one thing that stuck out at me, obviously, Tuukka Rask made an incredible number of saves. I think he had in the high 40s or low 50s. But I don't like that overtime goal that led to Boston being up 3-0. I mean, it was a clear-cut hook on Jágr. He got his stick up on Malkin, moved the puck down the boards, and then basically gave it to Marchand, who set up Bergeron. And I guess the way I look at it is, if it's going to be a penalty in the regular season or in regulation, I want to see it in overtime. And I know people say, well, you don't want to see the game decided by a crucial play or, I guess, a potentially bad call in overtime. But to me, the bottom line is you got to get it right. And so if I'm Pittsburgh, I would be pissed off that that's how I lost the game.
And hockey is actually the only sport that does that, really, with the unwritten rule of letting them play on type deal. Because you don't see that in the NFL ever. And I believe it was Damian Cox or something was saying that, would you have pass interference not called in a playoff football game if... just because you're letting them play on, is that playing on? So, yeah, I actually didn't see the hook myself, but I don't know what I was doing. I was probably in the kitchen or something. But then I saw the aftermath of the goal, and I got a few text messages from people. And the one thing I said was that Pittsburgh had a number of opportunities to win that game, so I don't think we can all hang it on that one turning point in the game when Jágr got the hooking penalty. I know that is what led to the goal and whatnot, but Pittsburgh had its opportunities and they had Boston in the right spot because they were getting a ton of scoring chances on their defense. And for one of the games so far out of the three they've played, they actually kept Boston close the whole time. So,
we see that Pittsburgh's down 3-0. We obviously remember that the Leafs took the Bruins to 7 games. How do you guys kind of frame that in terms of, you know, a what-if scenario?
Well, hindsight's 20/20, I guess, but I think if you're a Leafs fan, you're wondering to yourself right now, holy crap, I mean, if we beat the Bruins, then the Rangers would have been pretty easy to handle. And I don't necessarily buy the argument that people are making that, oh, Pittsburgh would walk over Toronto. I don't think that it's that it would be that easy of a win for Pittsburgh, personally, because in the regular season, Toronto actually defeated Pittsburgh twice, I believe, this year, and they actually matched up really well against Pittsburgh. So I think anything could have happened, really, and if Toronto squeaked out of that first round, you know, it's limitless, really, what could have happened. I don't know if they would have won the Stanley Cup. The West is pretty strong, but who knows, right?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it that much. I know some people have been saying that, but it seems like an eternity ago that the Leafs were in the playoffs to me. I mean, it's over and done with. You never really know. Even the Rangers series, people say, yeah, the way the Leafs were playing, they would have probably taken the Rangers. Well, who actually knows? The one thing I'll say about this particular series is last time out, people were saying if anyone could overturn a 3-1 deficit, it was the Blackhawks coming back against the Wings. And I'm going to say that if anyone can overturn a 3-0 deficit, it's Pittsburgh against Boston. So for all intensive purposes, is this series over? Probably. But I don't think it would be a huge shock if Pittsburgh did come back and win this series.
I don't see it, though. I can't see how their defense or goaltending can match up against Boston right now.
I just think that if they can get their guys going, I mean, does Crosby have a point in the series?
I don't think so. He definitely doesn't have any goals.
Right. So, I mean, Crosby gets going, Malkin gets going. Yeah, their defense and goaltending is not good, but I don't think that if Pittsburgh's going to come back, I think they're going to come back by winning a game where they score a lot. So maybe a 6-4 or a 4-2 or something like that. I think they need a blowout to get it going and just... I don't think they can play the tight checking game of Boston. I think they need to get goals, and obviously they need some saves.
It seems kind of shades of the year that Detroit beat Pittsburgh. The year that Pittsburgh did win the Cup and they beat Detroit, it was all Malkin, and Crosby was kind of invisible. And that year, I think, I don't know, I mean, now that both of them aren't going, you assume one of them's going to be hot at when the other one's not, right? And that's something that's working against Pittsburgh right now is that none of their stars, like you said, are scoring. James Neal had a really good shot last night, and I think he rang it off the post. And that was an opportunity right there that they could have won that game. And it's just the, you know, you talk about playoffs and you talk about game of inches, and it's all the small little details that always end up burning you in the end or being an advantage.
So are you saying they should have had Jordan Staal back? You're talking about stars who would have been helpful? And I'm only kidding, by the way. Most people know how I feel about Jordan Staal.
Well, I think Brandon Sutter scored. He's been scoring in the playoffs, so.
Yeah.
So game four of that series is tomorrow night. Tonight, the West Final has its game four. Chicago's leading the series 2-1. In one of the games, they actually were able to chase goalie Jonathan Quick from the game. Robin, any observations from that series for you?
Yeah, a couple observations. First of all, those games are on too late at night, so I've barely been watching. Never mind going into overtime just with the late start. But from the stuff that I have seen, I think this series has a chance of going the distance. I know the Kings have won, I believe it's 15 in a row on home ice. And I mean, I don't know what it is. I don't know that hockey is a sport particularly that has such a high winning percentage on home, like soccer or even in the NBA, where even teams who are 20-ish games under 500 tend to play 500 at home. I think that in hockey, mostly, if you're good, you'll have a very good home record with a good road record and vice versa. So I see this series going the distance. It's been a tight checking game, which series, which I think plays to LA's favor. And I mean, I wouldn't want to get into an offensive shootout with the Blackhawks. They've got Sharp, Taves, Kane, all kinds of guys who can score. And even though the names on the Kings roster, Richards, Carter, Dustin Brown, Kopitar, they should be able to score. I don't know if it's Sutter won't let them play the free-flowing offensive hockey, or whether it's, you know, just a conscious effort on their part to, you know, the old cliche, play a 200-foot game. So I just think it depends what style of game we see. If it's tight checking, I like the Kings' chances. If there's a little more offense, then I think Chicago is pretty much unstoppable.
I think Chicago is more balanced as a team against the Kings, given that they actually have almost four complete scoring lines, and their defense, they're pretty evenly matched up with Doughty, and then you have Seabrook or Keith on the other side. And
the not goalies, tonight, though.
Well, not tonight, the suspension. But, I mean, the both goalies match up really well. Obviously, Quick's the best goalie in the world probably right now. And
I'd agree.
I would say that maybe that game that he got chased out was a bit of a wake-up call for him. So I agree. I could see this going the distance. I think LA's play at home is just some anomaly. Like, it doesn't – I you can't explain it. I mean, that's the definition of home ice advantage. And they're going to exploit it and use it to bring this back to probably even tonight, I would say.
Yeah, I'd expect so, too.
Because they say it's not a series until both teams have played at home, so.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not in trouble till you lose at home, too, right?
So. Yeah.
You're listening to the RPM Roundtable Podcast on Centennial Internet Radio. So in class this morning, our instructor announced to us, and I don't actually know where he got this number, but he said that the Jays are projected to win 69 games this year. To put that in perspective, they won 73 games last year, and at this point in the season, they're 25-34. So, Mike, let's start with you. Can you see things actually ending up that bad where they win just 69 games this year?
If they continue at the pace they're going, for sure. But I heard an interesting thing listening to one of the out-of-market games the other day. I can't remember what broadcaster it was, but he said, you're going to lose 60 games in a season. It's what you do with the other 102. And that really actually made me think at the moment. And when you really think about it, that's very true. And given that the Jays are slowly getting back to a full healthy rotation, although Morrow kind of threw a wrench in that plan. Now the bats are struggling, but they're also prone to go into pretty short slumps, then come out of it, and then you see them play a game where they hit for 10 runs. So it's anything could go. It could go either way at this point, but obviously, you hope that they can pull something together and there'll be some meaningful baseball in August.
And I'm just going to go on record saying that the Jays will not lose less than, not win less than 75 games. I don't know where that prediction came from. I'm not sure if that's just playing at the current pace that they are now. Another thing I think to consider is that last year, on this date, the six teams leading the division, only one of them ended up actually winning the division, and the six last place teams on this date last year, only one of them ended up finishing last. So there's still, I mean, I'm not going to say it's early like we were the first 2 weeks in April or even the beginning of May, but there is lots of baseball left to play. Obviously, teams like the Pirates, who have even been in a playoff spot late July, early August, have fallen out 2 years in a row. And another thing to consider, I think this is the most extreme example. Last year, Oakland on June 6th, I believe, was 24-32, so 8 games under .500, something like that. And they ended up winning, I believe, 94 games and winning the AL West. So all hope is not lost for the playoffs. I'm not saying the Jays are going to win the division. I'm not saying the 2013 Jays are the 2012 A's, but it's not unprecedented for this, for teams to start so badly and overcome that kind of adversity or those kind of numbers. So have the Jays been good? No. But at the same time, I don't think they could play much worse, and I don't think all the things that have gone wrong can continue to go wrong over the course of a season, any more so than, you know, the Yankees with Overbay, Wells, Jason Nix. I heard an interesting stat about Ichiro the other day. Since the 1st of May, he has 2 extra base hits and 1 walk. So, I mean, their lineup is just horrible, and I don't think stuff like that can continue over the course of a season.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the A's came back and won their division. I know Oakland last year only had 3 other teams to leapfrog, but they were also last in their division at this point. And Texas, who was actually leading their division at that point, were 33-24, which is very similar to Boston, who is now 36-24. So, I mean, it's not a hole that they can't pull themselves out of, but you got to remember that Oakland went on a tear last year after the All-Star break.
Yeah.
And I think they were able to pull themselves close to .500 at the All-Star break and move from there. And actually, I'm going to propose this to both of you right now. I've got a friend who did a statistical analysis on last year's MLB season, and I think he based it around the Blue Jays at the time. It was from the halfway point, so I'm gonna see if I can get a hold of him at some point, and I'm gonna get him to do up this model for this year's Blue Jays from the halfway point. So we'll do it around the All-Star break time, and we'll get him to give us an accurate representation of how they finish. I believe his model finished 2 or 3 wins off what they actually finished
last year.
Yeah.
Nice.
So
okay.
It's pretty closely accurate. We'll see. Maybe there'll be some good news for Jays fans around that time. A little teaser for you there.
I'm in the front of the bar with a drink in each hand, living large with my I'm in the back.
We're back for the last segment on today's show. Last week we talked about the John Tortorella firing from the New York Rangers, and we proposed some possible replacements, none of which were Mark Messier or Wayne Gretzky. But apparently those are a couple names being floated around. Mike, what is your reaction to that?
I think it's a joke. Gretzky was a failed coach when he was in Phoenix. The whole thing was a big circus act to begin with. I mean, Gretzky didn't... I understand Patrick Waugh has done this the right way now that he's the coach of the Colorado Avalanche. He did this the right way. He went to the minors. He paid his dues. He coached junior. And now he's getting his shot in the NHL. And that's how it should be. It's not handed to you like everything was to Gretzky. And it's funny, too, that Messier has to go there, because the only reason that he was any good in the first place was because he had Messier playing with him. And, that's funny, actually, that if Messier actually goes there with him, I will laugh really hard for a good amount of hours, probably, because that's just so funny. And Gretzky is, I don't even know, it's just, he's got to be in the game, but he's got to stay out of the game at the same time, because he tries to put himself in these situations that he can be in charge and he can do these things. I would not mind Gretzky in maybe an advisory role, but not a coach. Come on. He was the worst coach ever.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. That basically took the words out of my mouth. I see guys like that, the so-called celebrity coaches, going to places that need to sell tickets. So even though he didn't have good teams in Phoenix, it made sense. It was a way to grow the game in Phoenix, get people excited about it. But I mean, New York is like Toronto. The team can be crap and in last place for a decade, and there's still going to be people in the stands. So I think that's totally ridiculous. And there's no evidence that either of those guys know anything about coaching. Like, it's not an automatic that because you played, you know, you make a good coach any more than all these players who they make analysts on TV. And they're just, some of them are just horrible. Won't name any names because I'm not trying to burn bridges here, but...
It's funny, too, because when Dave Tippett took over in Phoenix, the one thing I wanted more than anything was for them to go and win a Stanley Cup, because the team wasn't too different than the one that Gretzky had. So I thought it would be just absolutely hilarious if he won it with the team that he had, that Gretzky had, and couldn't take them anywhere. And the worst part about this whole thing is that we're going to have to live this twice in our generation. As soon as Crosby retires, he's going to do the same thing, because they're both the same player, and it's going to be the same situation, and I'll probably be pulling the remaining pieces of my hair out at the time, and it'll lead to that. And I'm looking forward to seeing if this actually plays out, because the Rangers are going to be made into a joke organization. And the other thing is too, is they have a team there that needs a real coach, not a some kind of a guy that just comes in and, oh yeah, guys, play, you guys know how to play hockey, so play
like
on,
I did
know.
yeah.
Now, Mike, you actually touched on an interesting topic there, and Robin, you sort of mentioned this too, that former players don't necessarily always make good coaches. I think Sidney Crosby, as you mentioned, would be a good example of that. In comparison to basketball, point guards often end up becoming good coaches. Is there something equivalent to that in hockey? Is there a certain position where, or a certain guy that you can see actually being a good coach?
Position-wise, I don't think that there's a natural fit. I mean, some assistant coaches, not really head coaches, a lot of them are these hard-nosed defensemen, I seem to find. And, I mean, I don't know how those guys, like, how that translates into becoming a good coach, because you actually need to think, and a lot of those guys are probably pretty concussed. I think the point guard makes a lot of sense in basketball, because that's probably the most... the position that requires the most thinking. So I don't think that there's an equivalent in hockey. I don't know why. I don't know what you think, Mike, if that's the position, like the stay-at-home defenseman.
Yeah, I have an interesting kind of idea with this. And I think it's always the guy that spends the most time on the bench. So a fourth-line guy. And if you look, too, I mean, Dan Bylsma was a fighter when he played. And now he's a tremendous coach in Pittsburgh. And I think it's the guy that actually gets the most time to sit around and observe the game and see the things that are happening. Much like a catcher in baseball, catchers generally make the best type of managers, Joe Girardi, et cetera.
Yeah.
And it's because they're managing the game already, playing in it.
Yeah,
and they're calling,
I think that's
the game.
A great way to put it.
So similar to a point guard, I guess you could say, but I think it is the guys that are role players and character guys and not necessarily the superstars, because they're not really seeing what's happening aside from what happens when they're on the ice.
And that's the thing, too. It's like I'm not saying that stars don't work hard, but I think that a lot of it is just their God-given talent or whatever you want to call it. And so how do you say to a guy who is clearly less skilled than you, you know, go and do this, oh, look, it came so easily to me. And I'm sure it's frustrating for those guys because they want whoever they're coaching to succeed, and they just, it's not possible just on a talent level. So,
yeah, I don't know what Scott Hatterberg's doing right now, but I could even see him being a good coach someday, because he was a guy that kept a book on everybody, and he really observed the game as well, and he played catcher a bit too when he started out.
Yeah.
And then moved to first base, and
even though he couldn't throw.
Yeah. Well, neither can Encarnacion, but for some reason he plays third base sometimes, cuz they got to get Lynn's bat in the lineup.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's just guys like that that actually, they're students of the game when they're already in the game. They're not just relying on their natural talent and abilities that were given to them. It's the guys that actually, the thinking men of the sport, just so to say, I guess.
You've been listening to the RPM Roundtable Podcast on Centennial Internet Radio.
Thank you for listening to the RPM Roundtable Podcast. Yes, here we go again.